Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, April 12th. Let the record reflect the time is 3:15 p.m. Today we have present Representative Fields, Representative Carrick, Representative Ruffridge, and myself, Chair Sumner. The staff will be assisting us today are Jordan Wright with House Records and Zachary Lawhorn with the LIO, and Clark Bickford, my committee, my staff and committee aide to House Labor and Commerce. Today we have a full agenda to go through, starting with the presentation on construction tax fraud by members of the Pacific Northwest Regional Council. Let the record reflect that Representative Prox and Representative Wright joined us at 3:17 p.m. If you guys would like to approach, should put your names on the record and begin your presentation. Thank you.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair Sumner and committee members. My name for the record is Chris Diamond. I am the regional manager for the Northwest Carpenters Union. And I just wanted to thank you for the opportunity to present on construction industry tax fraud today.
And my name is Gabe Shetty Farnsworth. I'm a representative with the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters. And we'd just like to thank the chair, Representative Sumner, and the committee for the opportunity to present today on construction industry tax fraud. This is an issue that we see becoming a bigger and bigger problem in our industry. And for that reason, our national organization, the United Brotherhood of Carpenters, has dedicated this week to what we're calling UBC Tax Fraud Days of Action. And as part of this campaign, to raise awareness and take action on this issue, our counterparts all over the country are engaging politicians, the public, and members of the media to shed light on this important issue. So, again, thank you for being a part of it with us here today.
As we move through here, please note that all the numbers that we reference are in the packets that we have provided you in the reports and different legislative samples that we've given there. And then also, if you'll take note, at the bottom left corner, I believe on every slide, there is a number of $52 billion. And as you progress through each slide, you'll see that number increases. That number has started, it's a ticker on our tax fraud website that has been tracking estimated costs to the American public since January 1, 2017. And you'll see that it's gone up exponentially just in the time it took me to put these PowerPoints together, but please don't let that reflect on how long it took me to put the PowerPoint together.
So, in this presentation, we're looking to outline what construction industry tax fraud is and what we believe can be done about it here in our state.
Do you want us to move through the slides? Is that?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. There we go. So first off, this isn't a union, non-union issue. This is a worker and a taxpayer issue. What is construction industry tax fraud? Well, it's wage theft, and that's just what it sounds like. It's stealing from construction workers. In a construction bid, the biggest variable in the total price is labor, and the best way to come in with a lower price is to find ways to shortcut your labor costs, which that often leads to shortcutting the worker, his or her wages, benefits, et cetera, unemployment insurance, workers' comp, et cetera. Worker misclassification is another form. That's where you misclassify the scope of work that a carpenter or a worker is doing. So say on a prevailed rate project, you hire everybody as a laborer on your job, and but they're doing carpentry work. You're saving $7.29 per employee, and so over the course per hour, at 2,000 hours, that's almost $15,000 per year per employee that employer is pocketing by misclassifying that worker, and so that worker is losing out on up to $15,000 per year.
Another method of misclassifying workers on construction jobs is classifying employees as independent contractors. And this is a problem across a lot of industries, but it's very prevalent in the construction industry. We have on the books pretty good language on ABC test here in Alaska in our statutes already, but there's still room for improvement as we see as far as like as far as oversight and enforcement of those existing laws. Some other places we see construction industry tax fraud are in cash payments for work. So whether that's cash payment for anything above 40 hours a week to skirt overtime, time and a half requirements, or just straight up paying cash for all of an employee's work under the table and completely skirting all tax obligations from the employer.
Another thing that we see, and we don't see it so much in Alaska, but it's really popular down in the States, is the use of labor brokers. These are a middleman that is a contractor will use one guy to go out and hire their entire crew. That crew does not report to anybody. They typically don't know who their employer is or who they're working for or who's paying them. When they do go to meet up on paydays, they typically meet at a check cashing location where they're either paid in cash or paid, you know, from a check that's been paid to the labor broker, and then he cashes that check and pays them out in cash. These folks are often their wages are stolen. A lot of times they're immigrant workers, and so they're not seeing, you know, a lot of times they'll just not be paid or underpaid what they were originally promised. Human trafficking is a part of this. We saw in Anchorage last summer, we had one of our Hispanic reps come up and were working with us, and he ran into a couple of Hispanic construction workers and started talking to them. These gentlemen were from Texas and Florida. They had been brought up to Alaska to work on various hotels around Anchorage. They were given half of their payment up front and told that they would receive the rest of the payment when the project was done, and the contractor took their green cards, driver's licenses, and passports, and essentially held them hostage in Alaska until they were done using them. It's a problem.
Yeah, non-payment of overtime, tax fraud, insurance fraud. We're going to talk about all these forms of construction industry tax fraud and other crimes like wire fraud as well. If a contractor, for example, is submitting fraudulent certified payroll that electronically, then that can qualify as wire fraud. So just some more of examples of construction industry tax fraud.
We'll go to the next. Yeah.
So, yes, who is impacted by construction industry tax fraud? Turns out it's a lot of different kinds of people and just a lot of people in aggregate. Construction is one of the largest industries in the United States and employs about 10 million workers. According to a 2020 Harvard study, it's estimated that nationally between 12.4 and 20.5% of construction workers are either misclassified as independent contractors or paid off the books completely. So that translates to between 1.3 and 2.16 million workers annually. And when I first got into the industry personally, I actually was one of those workers. I was working for a contractor on a prevailed rate project renovating a school on a military base in Anchorage, getting paid cash under the table. I was working overtime hours, getting paid at my straight time rate off the books. No fringe benefits were paid by my contractor. No workers' comp premiums were paid by my employer. No unemployment insurance. No Social Security or Medicaid taxes were paid by this employer. And so this is just one example. Through this example, you can see how lots of different people are affected by this illegal practice. Alaska workers, taxpayers. And then honest contractors. I mean, it also affects the honest contractors who bid that project and lost that bid because they were planning to pay and play by the rules.
Yeah, and with the honest contractors, you know, there are a lot of contractors in this state that do play by the rules. More and more contractors use subcontractors to skirt various laws. And so the more that happens, the more these honest contractors are losing out on work and construction opportunities, the fewer people they're able to employ, the fewer projects they get. Those contractors are faced with essentially two options. One, they close their doors, lay everybody off, or two, they start cheating as well. This impacts local businesses. You know, when you take, you know, $15,000 out of a worker's pocket. He's now not spending that at the local restaurants, the snow machine shops, the, you know, the hardware stores. All the local businesses now are seeing an impact from this. It also impacts nationally. So these are national numbers, but on average, it affects unemployment insurance for every one of these workers. It's $539 per year if that worker were to earn $30,000 for that year. That means UI is losing $539 for that worker. Worker comp premiums, that number is $1,300 plus per worker. Social Security and Medicaid lose $4,500 to $5,000 per worker per year. And that's just based on, it's a very conservative estimate based on a $30,000 income. And most construction projects in Alaska, construction workers are earning, you know, substantially more than that. So these numbers would be quite a bit bigger.
So, yeah, I mean, in general, we're talking about the degradation of the conditions of an industry that used to provide good jobs. I mean, it's in this state and throughout the country, and good jobs that allowed workers employed in them to stand on their own 2 feet and take care of themselves and their families. And today we find that 39% of construction workers, of families of construction workers, are enrolled in one or more social safety net program at a cost of almost $28 billion a year to the government. So it not only affects the funding of all of these different insurance programs on the front end, but then they're taxing and overburdening these programs as beneficiaries of them because they're not being paid the fair livable wages that they should.
So all of these numbers on here are conservative estimates of the national funding lost annually. Worker wages per worker, it's $16,000 per worker is lost. Total lost tax revenue is $8.2 billion across all 50 states. Workers' comp loses out on almost $2 billion. State unemployment's losing $700 million. Estimated overtime wages, that's $800 million that should be going into construction workers' pockets that someone else is taking and putting in their own pocket. Also, almost another $3 billion in lost federal payroll taxes, Social Security, Medicaid.
And we have the sources and citations for all of these figures can be found in all the material we provided the committee with today. I think it's worth pointing out and echoing what Chris said, these are all estimates of financial impacts on a national level, but we don't have any good data to work with for Alaska and our construction market in particular. There have been no studies that we're aware of that looked at the Alaska construction industry. So, but we would like to point out that our assessment and experience and our sort of boots on the ground assessment is that all of these practices we're talking about are being carried out here in our state, and they're definitely not uncommon.
So how do we combat this? It's going to take a lot of effort from a lot of different people. One way is drafting and supporting legislation. One component that is getting passed around the country now is general contractor liability. That means when a general contractor subs out work, that contractor is liable for lost wages for that employee if the subcontractor is not playing by the rules. The purpose behind that is to get the money that is owed to that worker in their pocket as quick as possible. There's a project going on in Ketchikan, Alaska right now. They're redoing the shuttle ferry from the mainland over to the airport. The subcontractor on that doing the pile driving was not remitting insurance or retirement payments and did not do so for months before they were caught, and they still to date have not paid it. So that means all of those workers that were working for that company, their health insurance has lapsed and none of their retirement has been made whole. So if there was general contractor liability legislation in place that would, you know, prevent them from hiring some of these scummier contractors, these guys could have been made whole by the contractor, and then he could go after his subcontractor. Again, contractors know who the good and bad subs are. And when they, you know, when they're utilized, they'll think twice about using some of these subs when they, you know, are faced with having to cover the financials for them until the subcontractor pays them back.
The next one we have listed there is industry partner program. So in other markets, we've looked around, and in Oregon, for example, the Multnomah County Labor Compliance Program, they've set up a system whereby they essentially deputize industry partners to aid in identifying instances of tax fraud. These labor compliance volunteers, as they call them, they work under and report to a labor compliance officer, and then they can go out onto construction job sites, interview workers, review certified payroll, et cetera. And, you know, in that area, in that market, it's proven to be an effective, low-cost way to drastically increase enforcement of existing law. And it can go hand-in-hand with additional legislation, you know, such as general contractor liability laws, like Chris mentioned. Also, we can strengthen independent contractor testing and enforcement of that, more investigators out checking job sites, especially in the residential market. We see it a lot. And increased Department of Labor and Workforce Development funding. That translates to more investigators on the streets and communities, and not just in our urban areas, in the cities. With the increase in construction spending we expect to see here in Alaska in the next 5 to 10 years, a lot of that will be on projects in rural communities. And currently, we just don't see coverage out in those areas by enforcement or compliance with wage and hour. And
looks like Representative Wright has a question.
Is this, thank you, Chair, through the Chair, is this something similar to Davis-Bacon? Is it something like that?
Through the Chair, Representative Wright, Davis-Bacon is lumped in with this. You know, people cheat on Davis-Bacon, yeah, as well as on the residential, on the private side of it as well. Some other areas we can, you know, improve things in this state is by supporting law enforcement, teaching law enforcement and the appropriate entities what to look for, how to identify cheating contractors, and to create laws that give them teeth and impact so that contractors quit cheating on this. I think if you were to increase penalties, beyond what is probably written into a lot of bids is just the cost of doing business when they are hit with a fine, that would have a lot of impact. Criminal penalties for egregious repeat offenders, increased debarment time. Currently, there's nobody on Alaska's debarment list, which I find interesting. And revoke contractor licenses, you know, period, if they continually are violating these laws.
And, you know, bottom line is all these measures, they come down to supporting honest contractors that are doing business properly and following the rules, the laws. And, you know, we can let them know by our actions that we have those contractors' backs and that they can bid and win those bids fairly. And they won't be penalized in the marketplace by just legally existing.
Right. Construction's tough. It's hard work. You know, I did it for 20 years. It takes its toll. You know, being paid what you are owed is very important in this industry, any industry, but, you know, this one's personal for us. So that really concludes our presentation. Thank you all for the opportunity.
Thank you so much. Does anybody have questions for the presenters? Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the Chair, and thank you for the presentation. I'm just curious on, I think, the second slide on worker misclassification. Are there currently definitions for different classifications of workers in different industries in statute or regulation somewhere? And is there any need to, I guess, tighten up the definitions for classifications to make it harder for folks to work outside of those fields?
Through the Chair, Representative Carrick, there is for prevailed rate work, Davis-Bacon work, which is what's publicly funded. There's pamphlet 600. It's Alaska prevailed rate code. There's a classification for each group of worker, but it's simple enough for a contractor, especially if they know that they're not going to have any oversight on their project, to pay them at a lower rate. And a lot of times a person working construction is just happy to get a paycheck. A lot of times they don't know that they're being misclassified or that they're being paid at the wrong rate or taken advantage of.
Thank you.
Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, I haven't looked at the larger report, but I think you said you don't have statistics or, if you will, hard evidence from Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Prox. That's correct. So in the materials we provided, there are a lot of studies that have been done in different areas and throughout the country. It's a difficult thing to get good numbers on exactly how many workers are being paid under the table because you don't have that in public data, right? So the first study, the Harvard study that was completed in 2020, it actually... What it does is it outlines a methodology for using public finance or public figures, rather, publicly available figures on wages and employment and getting to what an actual accounting is of construction industry economics, essentially. So you could apply that methodology that they've identified in any market. So, but no one has as far as we know, done that in Alaska.
Representative Fields.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Definitely appreciate the hearing, and it would be interesting to ask the State Department of Labor to share with us what is appropriate to share in terms of wage and hour investigations into wage theft, violation of prevailing wage laws, and so on, and at least get a significant amount of anecdotal information. And I'd be interested in seeing, you know, what do the investigators think that they are not capturing? A few years ago, I worked in the Department of Labor. A lot of state departments of labor were going to what was called a strategic enforcement model, where you basically didn't just go down the list of complaints received, but you look at who's the greatest risk based on the record. And, you know, I don't know if the department is employing a strategic enforcement model, but that's kind of a best practice. So it'd kind of be interesting to get the front line enforcement folks' views on it, because in my experience they're very committed to it, and maybe we can learn more about what they're saying.
Mm-hmm. Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. That was going to be my next question. If you, I would think that the Wage and Hour Board is the department or division that should be enforcing this. Have you talked to them, or is there someone from the division that is here that could answer? What are they doing, if anything? What has been done?
Through the chair, Representative Prox. We work with Department of Labor. Whenever we see issues, we take those issues to them. A lot of times what we see with the Department of Labor in the last 5 to 7 years is that they are not out investigating jobs the way they used to, unless they've been called specifically to a situation or a reason. And even prior to that, I worked in the field for 20 years. In that time, there was one time in 20 years that I had a Department of Labor investigator come on one of my projects. Mm-hmm. So I don't believe that there's coverage or necessary funding and resources to adequately be taking care of this.
Right. And was the Department of Labor invited to this today?
They were not today. We can follow up with them in a future date, though, probably. If you would like to.
And Greg. Yeah. And then there was a big number, $52.6 billion and change.
Yes.
Nationwide. And this, from what you're indicating, it's large public contractors working on publicly funded jobs.
Through the chair, Representative Prox. No, sir. This is all aspects of construction, private and public. Mm-hmm. You see in the private industry a lot. You see a lot more where people are paid cash, straight across the board. They're just paid off the books.
Mm-hmm. any more granular analysis? How much is private, small scale, I guess, residential top construction companies, and how much is, I would guess, pretty big companies that take on public contracts?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, we can follow up with that.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Fields.
Thanks. Through the chair, it has been a little bit of time since I researched this. My impression is that in a lot of Lower 48, you have, you know, illegal immigrants who, unfortunately, it's easy to steal wages because the boss says, well, if you report this, you'll be deported. I'd be interested in, like Representative Prox said, additional information from Alaska, you know, who are the groups who are most frequently targeted for wage theft? Is it immigrants? Is it someone else who, for whatever reason, is more easily exploited? And I just don't know that.
Well, thank you very much for the presentation. I guess I would add you probably missed child support fraud as well, because that is another factor. And I would say that this is a problem in Alaska. I mean, anecdotally, I've seen a lot of this, you know, and it does happen. So thank you.
Thank you.
I think we're going to move on to House Bill 149 from Representative Prox. Representative Prox, please approach, put your name on the record, and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Sumner and members of the Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, Representative Prox from District 33. And I'm joined today by my staff, Riley Nye, and Director Sylvan Robb, whom we always enjoy hearing from, with the Alaska Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. We're here today to talk to you about HB 149, which will enact the Multi-State Nurse Licensure Compact for Alaska, or in Alaska. And to explain why the Nurse Licensure Compact is needed, Alaska faces a debilitating healthcare workforce shortage. Combination of growth and turnover creates a need for over 7,500 new healthcare workers each year. There are currently more than 1,500 registered nurse vacancies in the state, and that number is projected to grow to more than 5,000 by 2030. Alaska's processing time for nurse licensure are at an all-time high due to significant increase in workload coupled with staffing vacancies and turnover over the last few years. At the same time as Alaska hospitals and healthcare facilities have record high vacancy rates, the Nurse Licensure Compact is a solution. It's currently enacted in 39 jurisdictions, with number 40 on the way as Washington's state legislature just passed a bill to their governor, and there's pending legislation in another 9 states, including Alaska. The Nurse Licensure Compact allows registered nurses and licensed practical nurses to have one multi-state license issued by their home state. It grants them the privilege to practice in their state as well as other compact states without obtaining additional licenses. To obtain a multi-state license under the Nurse Licensure Compact, a nurse must meet specific qualifications outlined in the compact language that must be adopted into law by all participating states, which Mr. Nye and Director Rob will cover in more detail. These requirements are more stringent than Alaska's, which ensures that joining the Nurse Licensure Compact will not lower the standard of care in our state. HB 49 will allow our hospitals and healthcare facilities to hire much-needed nurses more quickly while fully retaining Alaska's state sovereignty. Nurses are required to abide by all nursing laws within the state in which they are practicing, and the Alaska Board of Nursing retains full jurisdictional authority, including the ability to reverse a nurse's multi-state licensure privilege to practice in Alaska. Existing Alaska licensed nurses will have the option to convert their license to multi-state licenses or retain a single state license. Regulatory costs will be separated for single state and multi-state nurses to ensure licensing, investigation, and other regulatory costs for multi-state nurses or nurses holding multi-state licensure privileges in Alaska do not affect the licensing fees for single state nurses. The Nurse Licensure Compact will make Alaska a more friendly environment for nursing, help our existing nurses avoid burnout due to vacancies, assist our nursing schools in accessing more nursing instructors, allow facilities to fill vacancies more quickly, encourage graduates who want to travel to come back to Alaska, and make it easier for out-of-state nurses to make Alaska their permanent home. And it will provide increased access to care for all Alaskans. And with that, I'd like to hand the mic over to Mr. Nye and Director Robb to run through the presentation and provide a sectional analysis.
Good afternoon, Chair Sumner and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Riley Nye, staff to Representative Prox. I'm here to run through the presentation on HB 149, which, if passed, will enact the Multi-State Licensure Compact, or NLC, here in Alaska. You've probably heard about the NLC, as it's something the Alaska Board of Nursing, the administration, Alaska's hospitals, and many legislators have been working to get enacted in Alaska for about 4 years now. However, we recognize there may be concerns about the NLC, so today I'm going to talk to you about the problems the NLC can solve, what the NLC is, and why it's right for Alaska. I'll then turn the presentation over to Sylvan Robb, Director of the Alaska Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing, to talk to you about the facts around the NLC. Other states that have already joined, she'll talk about data the Board of Nursing has collected to confirm that a majority of Alaska's nurses do want this to happen, and other organizations that are supportive. Then we'll conclude by discussing the consequences if Alaska does not join the NLC and where to find more information. I think the first question we all ask when a bill comes before a committee is, what is the problem that this is trying to solve? Thank you. As many of you heard from constituents in Alaska's hospitals and healthcare facilities, there is a huge demand for nurses in Alaska, but licensure processing times are longer than they've ever been, as this slide notes. The Alaska Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development reports processing times to obtain a nursing license can take a minimum of 2 to 3 months, assuming the application package is complete, which oftentimes it is not. Director Robb can provide you more detail, but we learned that the Board of Nursing and Department worked very hard to streamline licensure as much as possible, with perhaps the most significant change being the issuance of a temporary license as part of the permanent licensure process. This has resulted in many temporary licenses being issued for the first time the application packet is reviewed, allowing the nurse to get to work while they're getting the final items for the permanent license. However, the lengthy processing times remain, and we understand from the department, which Director Robb can speak to more if you'd like, is that this is due to a significant increase in the number of applications being submitted and the severe vacancy and turnover rates the division experienced between 2020 and 2022. Certainly did not help, though thankfully that is resolving. To give you some specifics on volume increases, at the end of fiscal year 12, Alaska had just over 14,000 actively licensed nurses, which includes RNs, LPNs, APRNs, but does not include CNAs. At the end of fiscal year 19, there were a little less than 20,000 licensed nurses. And at the end of fiscal year 22, there were more than 24,000 nurses licensed in the state. Now, it's important to note that just because there were that many nurses and nurse aides licensed in Alaska, that does not mean that there were that many practicing. Nurses must obtain licenses here if they want to provide telehealth services to patients located in Alaska or instruct at Alaska nursing schools. And we understand that many nurses opt to keep their Alaska license active even if they're not practicing in the state or at all, because it's easier to keep a license active than it is to reinstate a lapsed license later down the road. As noted on the slide, the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association reported 1,500 nurse vacancies in the state at the end of 2022. This grew from 600-something at the end of 2019. Alaska is projected to have the highest nurse vacancy percentage in the country by 2030, with over 5,400 vacancies, according to registerednursing.org. Alaska has to remove the red tape to make it easier for these nurses to come up here, even if it's just on a temporary basis, so that we can get our vacancies filled. Creating a welcoming nurse environment in our state is more essential now, not just for our nurses, who are being asked more and more to work double or triple shifts or put in overtime, but also for all Alaskans. Everyone needs health care, and if hospitals and health care facilities face severe vacancies, we all suffer.
Looks like Representative Fields has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair on the slide, the department has long been very slow in processing these applications, and when we had hearings last session, the former division director was unable to explain why or what the department could do to speed it up. So I'm wondering, with the additional positions that I think we're funding, I don't remember if it's a supplemental or the operating budget, how much is that going to reduce the workload of folks who work at DCPD on things like nurse licensing? Thank you.
For the record, Sylvan Robb, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. Through the chair to Representative Fields, we do have, the governor did include 12 additional positions for the division in the budget for FY24. We would be directing several of those positions to the nursing team. It's always a balance for the division when we think about staffing, because we are a receipt-supported service. So as we increase staffing, that increase the licensing fees that applicants and nurses have to pay. A lot of why the nurse licensure process is very time-consuming now, and it takes a long time before we get to people's applications, is just volume. So currently, as of today, we have 5,300 in-process nursing applications. And just so you don't think that those are just have been sitting around, we've gotten 4,264 of those have been submitted since January 1st of this year. So most of the slow turnaround is just volume. We have a lot of people who are applying for nursing licenses. Last year, we issued over 5,500 new licenses to nurses.
Thanks, through the chair. If I could ask a follow-up. So if you're allocating 3 out of the 12 new positions to examining nurse licenses, what is the relationship between those 3 additional positions and your existing staff? Is that doubling staff, increasing it 10%? I don't know how many staff are working on right now.
Through the chair to Representative Fields, we currently have 10 people who work on the nurse licensure team, which is more than double the size of any of our other professional licensing teams.
Thank you.
I'll just continue on now, if that's all right. Further, we know from Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association, and I'll let them speak to this when they provide public testimony, but that about 1 in 4 non-resident healthcare workers that come up to Alaska stay and attain residency. That's about 25%, whereas our understanding is that the statewide average of non-resident workers that have become Alaskan residents is around 11%. So it's just about double for healthcare workers coming to Alaska that retain their residency here versus other healthcare or other workers that come to live in Alaska. Plus, we know that many people who come to Alaska temporarily end up staying the rest of their lives. Director Robb and legislators in this room are a great example of that. This is the best state. We just need to give nurses an opportunity to see that for themselves.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair to Riley. Do you have any information on how many nurses leave Alaska? And we see the net migration, immigration of population. People come in, they move out, they born, they die. Is there any net measurement of how many? I guess that we were hearing a lot about how nurses come into Alaska. How many leave Alaska? Can you just give me any information, ever statistics on that?
Through the chair, for the record, Riley Nye, staff to Representative Prox. It's my understanding that there's no, they don't have to, when they come in from out of state, or currently even, they don't have, they don't know who's has a single state license, who has a multi-state license, and how many people will be coming in through the NLC. And so with that's currently the same, and I'll let Director Rob speak more to that, if that's all right.
Yeah, for the record, Sylvan Rob. Through the chair, Representative Sadler, we don't track where nurses work now, or even if they're working within the state. It's the same with many professions. We don't, people need a license in order to practice their profession, but we don't keep track of if or where they're working. So we don't know who's working in Alaska or who's not at the moment. So we don't know how many people may have left.
Representative Fields.
Thanks to the chair. I was reading a study from the National Bureau of Economic Research that found it was a pretty interesting study because it looked at nurse shortages following the rollout of NLC in different states, and it found that there was no change in terms of staffing shortages post-adoption of NLC. So I was curious if you have found methodological problems with that study. It's the only study I'm aware of that looks specifically at the NLC using what I think is a pretty robust model. I also asked my staff to look at what are the states with the worst hospital staffing shortage and the states with the least bad staffing shortages. And what they found was 4 out of the 5 states with the biggest hospital staffing shortages are NLC members, and 4 of the states with the least bad staffing shortages are NLC members. So there seems to be no correlation. The state with apparently the best staffing is Nevada, which is not an NLC member. So I'm just not seeing data that shows the NLC addresses staffing shortages. So if you're aware of any such data beyond conjecture, I would appreciate seeing it.
Mr. Chair, if we may, we have Molly Maeve Lusk on the line from the National Council of State Boards of Nursing, who can probably speak better to what other states have seen. Before we go to Ms. Lusk, if I may, I would just say that we have received letters of support from a number of other states indicating that in the 4 to 5 years since they've joined the NLC that they've been happy with what that's done for their nursing population. Specifically to Representative Field's question, I'm not familiar with the study he's referencing, so it's hard to comment on, but Ms. Lusk may have additional information.
I don't believe we have her on. We have a Nicole Livinos from the NCSBN. Would that?
Yes, I may have misunderstood who was going to be on the line, Mr. Chair. She would be able to speak to it as well.
Okay. And then Representative Carrick, did you have a question?
Thank you, through the chair. And I apologize to the committee and the presenters because I do have to follow Representative Fields out of the room in a second here. But I guess I have one question I'm just hoping can get cleared up off the bat. So there was a backup document that came from the CBPL and State Board of Nursing that surveyed Alaskans, and we keep seeing in our support documents the statistic that 92% of Alaskan nurses support compacting. And I see in the actual survey that over half of the respondents considered Alaska their primary residence, but that was only 56% of respondents. And one of the benefits to a nurse license compact, my understanding, is that individuals can potentially transfer their license more easily between states. So who are these non-resident Alaska license holders? And can you better explain who those individuals are that were surveyed? And how that, and how an NLC provides a benefit that's not already existing by having these non-resident Alaska nurses.
Perhaps Sylvan Rob would like to take this one.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Carrick. Yes, so the survey was sent to, of nurses with an Alaska license. As you indicated, you've seen a lot of the quotes of the, so we got, it was sent to about 16,000 of the Alaska nurses that would have been registered nurses and licensed practical nurses. We received 3,573 responses. That gives you a margin of error on that survey of less than 2%. And of those who responded, so of the whole pool, 92% of people were supportive of joining the NLC, and only 3% of them opposed. So it wasn't the other 8%, but a number of people didn't have an opinion on the survey. And as you mentioned, that just over 2,000 of the respondents indicated that Alaska was their primary state of residence. And of those, 89% are in favor of joining the NLC. So the reason that you'll see nurses who have a primary residence in Alaska who may have licenses in other states, if you wanted to staff a, you know, call a nurse line as a telehealth doctor, you need to be licensed in every state where you were treating those patients. If any of our nurses who are Alaska residents are interested in teaching in other states, they need to be licensed in those states. The chair of our Board of Nursing is a great example of that. She only practices here in Alaska, but she holds licenses in three other states because she's an instructor at schools of nursing in those states. So there's a number of reasons why people are licensed in other states.
Just a follow-up. So 44% of those survey respondents were non-Alaska non-Alaska residents that are licensed in Alaska. So I thought that under the current system, to have an Alaska license, you had to be an Alaska resident. Is that not the case?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, you do not need to be an Alaska resident to have an Alaska nursing license. If you want to practice in Alaska, you need to have an Alaska license. So we have travel nurses who come in to provide those services, nurses with specialties. As I mentioned, if we have individuals who are teaching at any of our schools of nursing, people who are staffing telehealth, all of those folks need to be licensed in Alaska in order to treat Alaskans.
So just one more follow-up, if I can, through the chair. So there are several benefits to the compact, and at this point I'll just disclose that I'm leaning in support, but this is an interesting fact to me that I was unaware of until right now, because my understanding is one of the strong benefits of a compact was to more easily allow non-Alaska residents to come up and be licensed in Alaska. But if that's already a possibility, then it doesn't necessarily solve a current barrier. So could you maybe just elaborate a little bit on how an NLC is maybe expanding on the opportunity for non-Alaska residents to come and practice nursing in Alaska?
Yes, thank you for that question. Through the chair to Representative Carrick, it's a good question. So the way that this helps is currently if you're a nurse in another state and you would like to practice in Alaska, either physically come here, provide telehealth, provide instruction at a school of nursing, you need to get in that line of 4,300 in-process applications that we have right now in order to obtain an Alaska license. And as Mr. Nye mentioned earlier, it takes us, unfortunately, 2 to 3 months before we might get to your application. So it's not a quick situation for you to come here. So if Alaska joins the Nurse Licensure Compact, then if you're a nurse who's licensed in another state that's a member of the compact, which, again, most of them are, when you want to come and practice in Alaska, if you have a multi-state license from that other member state of the compact, you can just come and work. All you need to come and start working in Alaska is a job.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could ask, I'm trying to hang on every word, but I'm missing some of the words. Could we turn up Ms. Robb so we can hear her more clearly? I'm not sure if the microphone needs to be closer. You've got very important information to convey. I want to make sure I hear it. I heard you say 2 to 3 months. Is 2 to 3 months an excessive amount of time for someone to obtain licensure professionally? I seem to have heard, I'll say anecdotal horror stories of much longer than 2 to 3 months. Is 2 to 3 months excessively large given the general average of how long it takes to get a professional license in Alaska?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, speaking in general about professional licenses, it really varies from profession to profession, the length of time it takes to obtain a license for those individuals.
Just pretty close to it. Not far away, close.
Got to find the sweet spot. So it depends which profession it is, how long it may take. For hospitals or other facilities who are anxiously awaiting for a nurse to be able to start working, 2 to 3 months can feel like a long time. Additionally, for someone who is waiting to be able to start work and start obtaining paychecks, it can feel like a long time. And unfortunately, that 2 to 3 month waiting time is we receive your application in the office. 2 to 3 months later, we will pick it up. If it's complete, you'll probably get a temporary license right away. But if you omitted something, you misunderstood the directions, didn't read carefully, or you know, maybe transcripts weren't sent from your school, then there'll be another delay. So it can frequently take longer than 2 to 3 months. It's certainly not a standard that the division is happy with. We're interested in seeing it decrease.
Thank you. And follow up. I also have seen the cited statistic roughly presented as 92% of nurses in Alaska support licensure. I think when you dig down into the survey sets and the respondents, et cetera, I think there might be more instructive and a little bit more fair representation of that statistic, given that half people who are licensed do not live in Alaska, might have Alaska licenses. So, yeah, that 91% number seems to be just a tish misdirective.
Mr. Chair, to Representative Sadler, just for those people whose primary residence is in Alaska, it is 89% who were supportive of joining the compact. So you are correct that it is lower, but it's 89 versus 92. Yeah. But fair enough.
And a final question to ask, was the you mentioned a margin of error. Was the is this a scientific poll or was it a simple survey?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, it was a survey that was sent out to the nurses who are licensed.
Then I would observe through the chair that a poll requires random sampling to be valid and for the term margin of error to be valid. So you did do a survey, but not a poll. Thanks. Nope, no response to that, sorry.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. Just a question on the holding of a license in a compact state versus a state-specific license. Are you allowed to have both? Can you hold a license as a compact individual and then have a license in Alaska at the same time?
Through the chair to Representative Ruffridge, yes, you may. So obviously with 39 other states being members of the compact, many of those nurses whose primary residence is not in Alaska currently may hold a multi-state license in their home state, and then they also have a single state license here in Alaska. If you're asking if you're allowed to have a multi-state license in multiple states, that's not something that's allowed, and I don't really know what the purpose would be for the individual to, you know, pay the fees to obtain a license twice. So you can be licensed in a non-compact state in a as a single state license and then have a multi-state license from a compact state. Does that answer your question?
I believe so, yes.
Through the chair, Riley Nye, staff to Representative Prox. I'd also like to add that if you are hold a multi-state license in a NLC state and then you come up to Alaska and work here, if you gain residency here, you lose your NLC license, multi-state license. And I think Director Rob might be able to add something to that.
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, Mr. Nye is correct that once you become a resident of a non-compact state, you can no longer have that multi-state license. So it's one of the things that's a disincentive for nurses who hold a license to come back to Alaska, because once they establish residency in Alaska, then they've lost the ability to practice in 39, soon to be 40 other states.
So just to follow up to that, I want to make sure that I understand this, because I maybe misunderstood your first answer, because it sounded like you could do both, have a multi-state license. But if you come to Alaska to work and you want to be a resident here, you cannot have a multi-state license. You have to get a state-specific license for Alaska and rescind your multi-state license?
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Ruckridge. I apologize if that was confusing. So in order to hold a multi-state license, you need to be a resident of one of the states that's a party to the compact. So a person can do that now if you, you know, live in Idaho and you would like to come and practice here, then you need an Alaska license. You could have a compact license from your home state. But at the point that you change your residency and become an Alaska resident, you no longer have the option, as it stands now, to get that multi-state license because Alaska is not a member of the compact.
If I may. So let's say you live in a compact state. You're considering moving to Alaska, and you say, I'm a nurse. I want to move to Alaska. You have to make the decision if you're going to take up residency in Alaska to be unlicensed in all 39 states to be licensed in one.
Through the chair to Representative Ruckridge, yes, if the individual you're talking about, so you live in a party state to the compact, you're a licensed nurse, and you think, I'm going to move to Alaska. When you come here and establish residency, you need an Alaska license in order to practice in Alaska. And at the point that you establish Alaska residency, you are no longer eligible to have a multi-state license because you do not live in a compact state any longer. So we're hoping to change that.
Thank you.
I think we will hold the rest of the questions until the end of the presentation.
Through the chair, Riley Nystaff, to Representative Prox. I'll continue on the presentation, if that's all right. While the National Council of State Boards of Nursing is the organization that brings all state boards of nursing together, not only for the NLC, but also for regular nursing conferences and a way for all boards of nursing to know and communicate with one another, NCSBN does not have any governing authority over the NLC. NCSBN is an independent 501c3 nonprofit organization founded in 1978, and their membership is composed of boards of nursing and other nursing regulatory boards. The NLC is governed by the NLC Commission, which is made up of one administrator from each party state's board of nursing, meaning every state that's in the compact has an equal voice. Once a state joins the NLC, nurses with residency in those party states can apply for a multi-state license through their home state. If they meet the qualification for the license, which we'll cover on slide 6 and are laid out under pages 13 through 14 of HB 149, the nurse is granted a multi-state license that allows them to practice in all party states, reducing the administrative burden and cost on nurses if and when they seek to move to another state to practice. It would reduce the number of nursing license applications, CBPL, would receive, allowing division staff to process applications significantly more quickly. This is key to making Alaska more enticing and friendly places for nurses to work in supporting our healthcare entities. Single state nurse licenses are still offered, so nurses will have a choice. This also means a nurse from another state could still apply for a single state Alaska nursing license if they don't qualify for the multi-state license. As you can't qualify if you have had a felony conviction or ever been convicted of a misdemeanor relating to nursing practice, or if you have disciplinary action on a nursing license in another jurisdiction. In slide 8, we'll talk to you about all the states that are currently in the compact and those currently working to join. As the last bullet point on this slide notes, the NLC is an agreement adopted into law by all party states to recognize multi-state licensed nurses while retaining state sovereignty, authority, and enforcement ability. The agreement is what you see in section 18, starting on page 10 of HB 149. Every party state must adopt that language exactly as it's written. No changes can be made. This is a good thing because it means Alaska can have confidence that all party states have agreed to the exact same terms we are agreeing to. It also means the terms of the compact cannot change unless the Alaska legislature agrees with the changes, which means the legislature retains the authority to decide whether to remain in the compact if a change occurs, and if we don't, we drop out automatically with lack of action. The NLC Commission has the authority to adopt bylaws related to the operation of the NLC, but cannot change terms of the compact agreement language. When we reach slide 5, Director Rob will provide more specifics, but I want to briefly touch on some other parts of the compact language that would be adopted into law that provides assurances that Alaska will retain sovereignty and full jurisdictional authority over nursing practice in Alaska, regardless of the type of license a nurse is practicing under or what state issued the license. The requirements for licensure will be adopted into Alaska statute. All compact states have the authority to take action against a nurse's multi-state licensure privilege in that state, including revocation, suspension, and probation. Nurses must comply with all laws within the state where their client is located, regardless of their license type or the state that issued it. The compact specifically states that state sovereign immunity is not waived by the adoption of the compact. I think you may already be getting the picture of why the NLC is right for Alaska, but let me provide you with a little more. As I just covered, Alaska will completely retain state sovereignty, and the Alaska Board of Nursing will retain all the jurisdictional and enforcement authority over nurses practicing in Alaska that we have now, regardless of the nurse's license type or which state issued it. The contract or the agreement we'd adopt into law assures it. The only difference is that the Board of Nursing would take action against the nurse's multi-state licensure privilege here if their license was issued by another party state rather than the license itself. However, it would have the same effect as if an Alaska license was disciplined, including revoking the nurse's privilege to practice here. And if that happens, it's reported to the home state and all party states. This makes Alaska a more friendly environment for both Alaska nurses and out-of-state nurses because it allows them to get to work more quickly and avoid the costs and delays created by single state licensure. It also provides more incentive to work in Alaska longer or make Alaska their forever home because they would no longer be at risk of losing their multi-state license and ability to practice in 39 U.S. jurisdictions if they move to Alaska, as you cannot retain a multi-state license if you establish residency in a non-compact state. It increases access to care for all Alaskans because it allows our healthcare entities to more easily recruit and retain the nurses they desperately need. Alaska's nurses work very hard, and unfortunately, lots of vacancies result in lots of extra shifts for the existing nurses. No matter how amazing you are at what you do, a nurse is going to be less on it at the end of a double or triple shift than they were in the first shift. Reducing the amount of double and triple shifts our nurses are required to work not only provides them better support, but offers better care for all Alaskans. The NLC will make it easier for our nursing schools to find and hire qualified instructors, therefore helping Alaska's effort to grow our own nurses. Right now, we only graduate around 325 nurses each year. Additionally, we hear anecdotally from the nursing schools that many students want to be travel nurses when they first graduate. So they leave Alaska and establish residency in a compact state so they can obtain one license and move between states freely. This won't discontinue, but we need to make it easier and more enticing for these Alaska nursing graduates to come back to Alaska, either periodically or once they are ready to settle down. Finally, we can't be confident that the standards of care will not be lowered by joining the NLC, since all of our licensure requirements are either equal to or greater than Alaska's, and Director Rob will provide more information on that. Thank you. I'll now pass it over to Director Rob.
For the record, Sylvan Rob. So I'm going to start by talking about the facts of the NLC. As Mr. Nye pointed out, this absolutely does not result in a loss of state sovereignty for Alaska. And to give you specifics, and I hope you'll bear with me a little bit, as some of this may have already been redundant to what Mr. Nye provided, but I want to point out where in the compact language within HB 149 you can find and verify the things that we're asserting. So in Article 3, Subsection C, which is on pages 13 and 14 of the bill, that outlines the requirements a nurse must be able to meet to qualify for a multi-state license. And again, all states must agree to those requirements without exception. No one is grandfathered. In Article 3, Subsection D, which is also on page 14, it allows all the party states to take adverse action against a nurse's multi-state licensure privilege in their state, such as revocation, suspension, and probation. The compact also requires that boards of nursing treat adverse action against a multi-state licensure privilege the same as they would take action against an in-state license. So they can't sort of keep shuffling those discipline items to the end of the line. Article 3, subsection E on page 15 requires a nurse practicing in a member state to comply with the state practice laws of the state where the client is located. So this is not limited to patient care, but again, all nursing practice as defined by state practice laws, such as the practice of nursing in a party state under a multi-state license or privilege, subjects a nurse to the jurisdiction of that state's licensing board, its court, and the laws of the party state where the client is located. So on Article 5, which is on pages 16 and 17, you can see where the compact provides the authority for the State Board of Nursing shall have, in addition to the other powers conferred by state law, meaning we retain all the authorities we have now, plus some. Article 7, subsection A, subsection 3 on page 19, specifically states that nothing in this compact can be construed to be a waiver of sovereign immunity. And finally, Article 10, subsection F on page 30 outlines that no amendment can be made to the compact that's effective and binding until all of the party states' legislatures have adopted that change into law. The qualifications to obtain a multi-state license are more stringent than Alaska's, so there's no risk of a lowered standard by joining the Nurse Licensure Compact. And I'll go over specifics of that more on the next slide.
I'd prefer we hold them to the end, Representative. Go ahead, I suppose.
That's okay. Okay.
We have heard one concern is that if Alaska isn't the one licensing all nurses working here, we won't know who's practicing in our state. And as I mentioned earlier, we don't know who's practicing here now. We know who has a license in Alaska, but we don't know which of those licensed nurses are working. We don't know where they work. So that's not information that we currently have that we'll be losing. We'll just be continuing to exist in the state we are now. Finally, we wanted to say that the Alaska Board of Nursing, again, Board of Nursing appointed by the governor and approved by the legislature, is tasked by the legislature. They have the jurisdictional authority over all nursing practice and licensure in the state. They don't have any concern with the ability, the inability to track nurses, and neither do we as the licensing division. The administration doesn't, AHA doesn't, the huge number of Alaska's hospitals that avoid support obviously don't find that to be a concern, and even the APRN Alliance, all of which have supported letters of support. While we can't speak with certainty to how joining the Nurse Licensure Compact will impact nurse licensing fees, that would be impossible until we actually join. But we do anticipate that we could actually result in lower fees for licensees. Since Alaska Statute 08-01-065 requires our department to set fees based on the regulatory cost to run a licensing program, and Section 2 of HB 149 requires the department to track the regulatory costs and set fees for the single state licenses separately from the multi-state licenses. So in the event that we see a huge uptick in cost related to multi-state licensure, which, again, we don't expect, but were that to happen, any nurse with an Alaska-specific license would not incur any of those costs. Additionally, joining the Nurse Licensure Compact will result in fewer applications to be processed by our team. Again, just to bring you back to that figure I gave you earlier, that we have 5,300 nursing applications in process right now, 4,200 of which we've received since the beginning of the calendar year. That decrease in the number of applications that we're processing could result in fewer staff that we need on that nurse licensure team. We'll have plenty of use for those staff working on other programs. So there's no concern about anyone losing their job. But we actually think that we might see fees for single state licensees be decreased as we need fewer licensing examiners to process those applications for Alaska-only licenses. And we do want to acknowledge that, we're not claiming that the nurse licensure compact will be the silver bullet. Alaska joining the compact does not magically create a pool of nurses that we suddenly have access to that's greater than what exists now. But as we think about moving forward and being one of the last states who's not a member of the compact, we're just making it that much harder for a nurse to be interested in coming to Alaska. Whereas Mr. Nye mentioned, you know, we're retaining almost a quarter of the healthcare professionals who come up and give Alaska a try. So we want to make it easy for folks to come up and give Alaska a try and fall in love with Alaska. And finally, as was mentioned earlier, the commission for the Nurse Licensure Compact is made up of one voting member from each party state's board of nursing. So Alaska, if it joins the compact, will have an equal say in voting on, again, not the body of the compact or the rules that govern what's required to get a license, but just the bylaws that govern how the compact work is run. So here you'll see the qualifications for nurse licensure, and this is a comparison of what's required for a multi-state license versus what we require now for Alaska. And you'll see that the multi-state licensure requirements are higher, equal to or higher than what we have for Alaska. So to obtain either of these licenses, you need to have graduated from a board-approved or accredited international education program. If you're coming from an international program, you need to pass an English proficiency test. All applicants must have passed the National Nursing Exam, which is called the NCLEX, and they must have passed a state and federal background check through the submission of a fingerprint card. And so as you can see on this slide, number 3, 4, and 6, these requirements are in regulation, not in statute. So for Alaska licenses, if the Alaska Board of Nursing wanted to change those requirements, they could. But for those items that are with a multi-state license in the compact, that would be in statute. And so it would be unable to be changed except by the legislature. And here's where the differences come in between the multi-state licensure requirements and a single state licensure requirement. So for the multi-state license, you cannot have been convicted of a felony. You cannot have been convicted of a misdemeanor related to the practice of nursing. And you cannot have any discipline action against your nurse license in any state. You can't be currently enrolled in an alternative to discipline program. Those are frequently related to substance abuse disorders. And nurses are required to self-disclose their participation in those programs. So in Alaska, we don't have these blanket prohibitions against people who have criminal convictions. So they're assessed on a case-by-case basis by the Board of Nursing. So again, if somebody is has those and has a current license, they will be able to continue to practice with the Alaska-specific license. We're not pushing anyone out of work. So the NLC in other states, because obviously this will have us join a group of 40 other states, soon to be 40. So the party states have reported that the Nurse Licensure Compact is an essential retention and recruitment tool. And they report no significant increase in investigations or fees as a result of joining the NLC. And just so you know, the NLC has been around for 20 years, so some states have a very long history with this, so there's a lot of good data. You'll see in your packets that we do have letters of support from other boards of nursing in other states and from the Missouri Hospital Association, indicating that they've been very happy to be part of the NLC. As we've mentioned repeatedly, 39 jurisdictions have enacted the NLC, and we do have a map on the next slide that you'll be able to see. And that slide shows that 9 states have pending legislation. Obviously, that gets us very close to Alaska being one of the last or the last states if we were to not move forward and join the compact. And it was noted that Washington passed this week their bill to join the NLC. That bill passed 94-4, so it is just awaiting the governor's signature. The 8 other states that have legislation pending to join the NLC, aside from Alaska and Washington, Oregon, Nevada, Hawaii, Minnesota, Illinois, New York, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island. So there are only a handful of jurisdictions that are not currently working to join the compact. Those are California, Michigan, Connecticut, Washington, D.C., and several of the U.S. territories. And again, any of them could move to join the compact. Since just a couple weeks ago, Alaska would have been on that list as well. As we've discussed, all compact states have an equal say on the NLC commission. But of course, right now we don't get a voice because we're not a member of that. So again, we've hit this. This is the last time, but every party state has to adopt the exact same language of the compact into their state statutes. And that gives you the certainty that you can trust that the terms of the compact cannot change without your knowledge and approval. Once this is in statute, the only people who can change it are you. So here, slide 7 just shows which states are in the NLC now. I do want to note the partial implementation in Guam. They're just in the middle of that. It doesn't mean that you can adopt a portion of the compact and not all of it. They're just to the point where they are receiving multi-state licensees, but they're not to the point where they're issuing multi-state licenses, but they will be soon. We've touched on this survey, so I'll be brief because I know there's other things on the agenda today, Mr. Chair. Again, we just want to, and we'll stick with the Alaska specific. So of the more than 2,000 Alaska resident nurses who responded to the survey, 56% of those individuals were supportive of joining the NLC. Only 5% were opposed. I'm sorry, 56% of the survey respondents have a primary residence. 89% of them are supportive of joining the compact. We also included the full survey with the methodology and questions were provided to you. They're also available on our website. And I think this is a good time to note that not only has the Alaska Board of Nursing membership voted unanimously in support of joining the NLC for the last few years, but the APRN Alliance, so the Advanced Practice Registered Nurses, has also submitted a letter of support, which is also in there. And it's worth noting that in order to be an Advanced Practice Registered Nurse, you need to have a valid RN license in Alaska. So here on slide 10, you'll see a list of the coalition of support that's been identified on AHA's flyer. And I think this is also in your bill packet. There are over 75 organizations listed. Of course, we're not going to read all those. But I do want to point out a few key organizations that we haven't mentioned, the AARP, the Alaska Chamber, as well as several regional chambers, the Alaska Municipal League, the Alaska Native Health Board, many specific Alaska hospitals and medical centers, the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, and actually all of the Department of Family and Community Services, so including the Pioneer Homes, which employ a great number of nurses, are supportive. Alaska Schools of Nursing are supportive. The State Medical Association, the National Military Family Association, the National Student Nurses Association, SEARCH. Again, I could go on and on. There's a great deal of support for seeing this bill, and we expect to see support continue to flow in. And with that, I will pass it back to Mr. Nye.
Thank you. For the record, Riley Nye, Staff to Representative Brooks.
Mr. Nye, I think we're going to have to continue this on Friday just because we do have another bill presentation and other business, but I believe we have you on the schedule for Friday. So.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, we will move on. We have Representative Vance presenting her HB 21 bill. Representative Vance, please approach the committee, put your name on the record, and begin.
Thank you, Chair Sumner, members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is Representative Sarah Vance for House District 6 of the Lower Kenai Peninsula.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Jake Almeida, Chief of Staff to represent Vance.
It is no secret that school districts are facing challenges recruiting and retaining teachers and support staff that is compounded by the rising cost of healthcare. As a representative and wife of an elementary school custodian, I hear you. This fall, I attended my local school board meeting where I heard the teacher representative for healthcare insurance plead with the school board members to have an emergency meeting to discuss what they could do to help retain teachers due to the increase of healthcare premiums for families. It was at that moment that I offered House Bill 21, school healthcare consolidation, as an option for the school district to pursue should it be the will of the legislature to support and pass this concept. The bill has been offered and heard in prior legislatures, but only as a full requirement of all school districts. This bill is distinctly different in that it supports local control and is 100% optional. According to the 2019 ICER research summary number 2019-4, titled How Much Does Alaska Spend on K-12 Education? Subsection of What Drives the Cost of Public Education in Alaska, it states that three Alaska exceptionalities set us apart from other states in our education spending patterns: small schools, healthcare, and energy. Alaska has the highest per capita healthcare cost in the U.S., which negatively affects private and public sectors of our economy. Healthcare costs are part of teacher compensation. And as you see here, while the challenge of high healthcare costs is not unique to education, in a fixed budget scenario, these costs put downward pressure on wages, making it more difficult for Alaska districts to offer teachers a nationally competitive salary. My goal is to ease the financial burden of school districts and give the state of Alaska more leverage to negotiate with healthcare providers, improving services for Alaskans with the potential of saving millions of dollars. House Bill 21, School University Employee Health Insurance, amends current statute to provide the option to school districts, the University of Alaska, and governmental units such as cities and boroughs to participate in Alaska Care, the state employee health care program. These entities would have the choice to opt into the pool as an entire entity, enabling the Alaska Department of Administration to negotiate a better cost. So what are the benefits of consolidation? Well, the obvious is that it saves money. By expanding the number of participants in a healthcare pool, the potential for savings increases. Most of our school districts are small and must carry the burden alone. Several school districts have responded favorably, and even one has reported potential savings of up to $7 million a year. Previous estimates concluded a savings of at least $200 million per year if all school districts chose to consolidate healthcare under one plan. While the amount of savings is determined by the number of participants, healthcare consolidation is an option worth pursuing. The second is that it provides more healthcare options. Some school districts are facing challenges, such as my school district, shopping the market to find affordable healthcare due to high-use members. This bill expands options with a larger pool to more easily offset the high use. And the last one is that it reduces staff burden. Schools who choose to consolidate will reduce staff burden of having a dedicated employee who is responsible for managing a healthcare plan. This flexibility will free up staff to focus on what matters most, providing a quality education for our children. The option of consolidation is intended to help reduce the cost of education, but is also available to University of Alaska, our local municipalities, and our local municipalities and boroughs. Each governmental unit can find a healthcare plan that fits their individual needs and budget by working together. So now, Mr. Chairman, if it is your will, I'd like to defer to invited testimony.
Yeah, looks like we have Randy Traney from the Mat-Su Borough online. Go ahead, Mr. Traney, if you're on, put your name on the record and you can begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Randy Traney. I'm the superintendent of the Mat-Su Borough School District. And I want to thank Rep. Vance for the opportunity to testify on this bill. It's been a priority of my board for 3 years to look at ways for districts like ours to have an option to participate in this. And I want to be very clear, this would need to be negotiated with our collective bargaining agreements, so and our four unions. But if I was able to wave a magic wand this year, and if we had been able to participate, and all of our employees participated, we know that the difference in premiums between what we're currently offering and what we're currently paying on the district side is a $5 million savings. And then the employees would also see considerable savings. It's harder to get a real firm number on this one because it would be determined by which current rate employees are paying, so which plan they've opted into and which one they might opt into were this available. But it's roughly another $2 million. So for us, that's a $7 million savings. Or to put it in a different way, it would be the same as if there was a $135 increase to the BSA for the Mass Super Oak School District. So we're just really in support of this as an option. It would need to be negotiated. And I can answer any questions that the committee may have.
Okay. Thank you. Oh, Representative Prox.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, did I understand you to say that effectively the school board could support this idea, but it hinges on whether your collective bargaining unit approves it?
Yeah, so healthcare and salary, of course, are the things that it always comes down to when you're bargaining. Our current collective bargaining agreements specify which healthcare plan will be used for each year and what percentage of that plan the employee pays, what percentage of the plan the district pays. So if this were an option, then the district could have looked at it this year and we could have made a proposal that instead of going with the current healthcare plan that we have, let's go to this one because it would save everyone money. They'd have to agree to that. And, you know, like I say, if we could wave the magic wand, I'm not sure why anyone wouldn't agree to saving $2 million of employee actual dollars that they're currently paying out. But we would have to negotiate that.
Thank you. I'll follow up.
Go ahead.
Yes. Thank you. Through the chair, have you looked at kind of the details behind the state's healthcare policy and the one you currently have as far as deductibles and coverages and copays and things like that? Are they pretty much
apples to apples? Through the chair, only, you know, not in depth other than to make sure that the plans were fairly comparable, that there wasn't a dramatic difference between what the state was offering and what our employees currently enjoyed. If they're very, very similar. If anything, the state's plan may be slightly better than what our employee groups currently have offered to them.
Thank you.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. Through the chair to Mr. Traney. So I have heard now a couple of times figures about savings with enrolling in the group plan through the state versus districts going out and seeking their own coverage or needing to seek their own coverage. I'm still not able to put the nuts and bolts together of how that savings comes to be. There's obviously a cost per person for coverage to the entity, whether that's the district or the state. Do you happen to know what your cost is per person to offer insurance within your district?
We do have four different groups, and so they're all slightly different. But our largest group, which is the MAPSU Education Association, which are our teachers, the district portion is $2,000 a month this year. And then the employee pays additional amount on that, and there's a range. They pay anywhere between $4,000 and $6,000 on top of that. So the total cost for a person to be covered is between $28,000 and $30,000. a year. Excuse me.
Okay. Follow up, if I may. Do you happen to know, or maybe for the bill sponsor, what the cost is per person under our state insurance currently for the state's cost? So I have the handout here, but I don't think this is an employee premium, which is not the same as what the state pays per person. And I'm wondering if we have that number.
Vice Chair Ruffridge, if I may, we have Ms. Betsy Wood, the healthcare administrator from the Department of Administration for Alaska Care online, who may be able to answer that question.
Be wonderful. Thank you.
Hi, this is Betsy Wood. I'm the Chief Health Administrator with the Division of Retirement and Benefits. Chair Sumner, would you like me to answer the question?
Yeah, you can go ahead. Thank you.
Sure thing. So the state pays a per employee per month employer contribution, which for fiscal year 23 is $1,685. And that's in addition to the employee premiums that are paid monthly by employees, and those vary based on the plan that the employee elects.
Okay, follow up if I may. Do you know what that range is per employee? Is that the sheet that I have in front of me potentially?
Through the chair, potentially. I'm not sure what you have in front of you, but it does vary. So if an employee chooses employee-only coverage, it ranges from $25 per month for the consumer choice medical plan up to $125 per month for the standard medical plan. If the employee elects to cover themselves and any family members, that range is $71 to $303 per month.
Okay, thank you.
I think I have a question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Fields.
And thanks to the chair. I don't know if this is a question that's best for the bill sponsor or a departmental representative, but I'm curious if there's been any modeling looking at groups of employees and their, I guess you would say plan experience, I think would be the right term, moving from, say, a plan with local government, moving into Alaska Care, what that would mean for Alaska Care. Do you have incentives for groups to move back and forth? Has that been considered in deliberations on this bill?
I believe Ms. Wood, through the chair, would be the best person to answer that from the administration.
So this is Betsy Wood for the record with the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And through the chair, the division has looked in the past at some scenarios, but that data is a little bit old. As far as an analysis for this bill, what that would look like, we haven't completed that yet. That's typically the type of analysis that we would lean on our actuarial consultants to assist with, and we typically do our actuarial analysis when a bill reaches the Finance Committee.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, if I can do a follow-up. It just seems like, you know, God forbid you had a poorly managed plan before that then joins Alaska Care, it could actually cost the state more money, and I would just want to understand, is that a concern we should be thinking about? What is the cost and what's kind of the balance of helping people who maybe haven't had the best plan before, but on the backs of current state employees and potentially the opportunity cost of funding state programs? And I just don't feel like I have a great understanding of that.
Through the chair, again, this is Betsy Wood. I can take a stab at that if you like.
Go ahead, Mrs. Wood.
Sure. This is, unfortunately, the answer really is it depends. There are a lot of factors that go into what the cost impact would be to the existing Alaska Care program associated with incoming groups. You know, it'll depend on the group size, but also the claims experience for that group. So You know, really the best answer I can give you is that it could go in either direction. It could potentially increase costs for the existing Alaska Care program. It also could potentially bring those costs down. There's a lot of variables that could come into play, but that impact to the existing Alaska Care program is certainly a component to consider.
Can I ask a related question, Mr. Chairman?
One more.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. Through the chair, and I guess this question is probably for Ms. Wood. So I think the two largest plans or plan groups out there are Alaska Care and the Pacific Health Coalition. And, you know, this bill is opening up Alaska Care. I don't know if there's also been examination of whether some of these groups have tried to join the Pacific Health Coalition and whether the Pacific Health Coalition is not one of them because of prior plan experience, or I guess I'm interested in just stepping back a little bit and saying, well, if our goal here is really to pool, is this the only opportunity to pool and achieve economies of scale, or might there be other opportunities out there? And Ms. Wood, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. Maybe this is the only opportunity. I just would want to make sure of that.
Through the chair, I would say I may not be best positioned to answer that. You know, I think there are other opportunities for pooling as far as the Pacific Health Coalition goes. The Alaska Care Plan actually does participate in the coalition, but there's also, you know, there are other kind of pooled or consolidated healthcare options, and I think some of the school districts may already participate in some of those consolidated options. But as far as is this the only option out there, I think the answer would be no, but that's probably the best insight I can give you right now.
Thank you.
Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, I think I'm understanding you to say that the financial questions can only be answered with an actuarial study, and that doesn't get started until the bill gets to the Finance Committee. Is that correct?
Through the chair, typically, yes, that's correct. But when we need to pull in our actuarial consultants to assist us with impacts kind of this magnitude, that typically occurs when the bill makes it to the Finance Committee.
And follow-up, roughly how long will it take to obtain that study once somebody says go study it?
Through the chair, that's a great question. It depends on the scope and the magnitude. It could be a few weeks is my best guess, but I would need to scope it out with our consultants.
Okay, thank you.
And Representative Ruffridge. No? Okay. All right.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, for clarification to answer Representative Fields' question about the potential added burden to the state, the bill is very clear that those who choose to pool into Alaska Care will pay for their portion of the health insurance. So the idea is that they will still contribute and carry their burden, but by pooling together, it should, in time, depending on how many people choose the option, will reduce the burden overall.
Thank you, Representative Vance. Does that conclude your presentation?
Those are all that we have today. I know that we had Ms. Wood available for any potential questions, and just for clarification, the employee premiums chart that was provided came from the administration in response to a question that Representative Ruffridge asked in a previous meeting, so that we wanted to have that available. And I know that you are pressed for time, so I thank you and the committee members for your time and consideration of this bill.
Thank you, Representative Vance. And we will move on to House Bill 86, a bill by the request of the governor. Spent a lot of time on this bill, received one amendment from Representative Fields, which we will discuss now if there is a motion.
Sure, I'll move Amendment 1.
Objection.
Okay.
Thank you, and I'm going to actually defer to Mr. Chairman. I'm actually going to defer to Representative Wright whether he wants to take this opportunity to addressed payday lending. When I saw this bill moving forward, I noticed that he has a bill that I support on payday lending, and given a bunch of things going on, I asked for an amendment to be drafted to roll essentially his payday lending bill into this bill. If he wants to do that, I'd certainly support it. If he doesn't want to do that at this time, it is his bill, and I will withdraw the amendment. So just wanted to see whether we should do that at this stage. Thank you.
Well, it does appear Representative Wright has objected. Representative Wright, would you like to speak to your objection?
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair. I do not want to at this time add this, roll it into this bill. I think it's inappropriate. And it's a large, substantial bill, and I don't want my bill to get lost in it.
Okay. No problem, Mr. Chairman. Like I said, support the underlying bill, and I'll withdraw the amendment. Thank you.
Okay. Amendment has been withdrawn. Vice Chair Ruffridge, what's the will of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House Bill number 86, version A, also referred to as 33-GH1312/alpha, be advanced from the committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Okay, without objection, House Bill 86 has been moved from committee. I'm now going to, we're going to move on to House Bill 88 from Representative Rauscher. I'm going to open public testimony. Is there anybody in the room that wishes to testify on House Bill 88? No. And I don't see anyone online. Mr. Fitzgerald, if you would like to testify. Oh, Patrick Dolan. Not seeing that. Well, Patrick Dolan, if you're online and you wish to testify, please proceed. Thank you.
Yes, I do. I'll make this quick. I know it's getting late for everybody, but I just wanted to say good afternoon. And my name is Patrick Dolan, and I am a member of the Teamsters Local 959. And I have worked in I've worked for Car Safeway Warehouse for 20 years, and I'm calling to testify in support of House Bill 88. The Workers' Warehouse Protection Act. I feel like House Bill 88 provides warehouse and logistic workers the ability to have access to their work speed and data up front, compensation packages so workers are aware of their tasks and standards which they are to be compensated for. House Bill 88 also allows workers to use restroom facilities and take breaks without the risk of being reprimanded for dropping at work speed. As a warehouse worker myself, I know that when crunch time is necessary and everyone work together to make sure pallets are wrapped and out for delivery on time. We have very little downtime, but throughout our collective bargaining agreement, we were afforded the ability to use the restroom and sit down, which I feel improved safety and work speed. That's about all I got. I just wanted to call in, like I said, and show my support for this bill. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Dolan. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Dolan, a question for you. Help me understand, our worker quotas in warehouses something that is provided for in negotiated contracts? Not sure.
Who's that directed to?
To you, sir, yes.
Oh, I'm not sure on that. I, like I said, I'm just calling in on this. I do not know all the logistics on that. That's kind of above what I have in front of me.
Very well.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Dolan.
Thank you.
Is there any other public testimony? No? And anybody else in the room? No? Well, we will close public testimony on House Bill 88. We will set this bill aside to notice a amendment deadline, aspirationally for Friday. So last on the agenda today is...
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, Representative Fields.
Sorry, just a clarification. Friday, like in the morning, or what time for the amendment deadline?
Meeting time.
Oh, sounds good. Thank you. Okay.
Last on the agenda is public testimony for HB 112 from Representative Ruffridge. I'm going to open public testimony now. Is there anybody in the room wishing to testify on House Bill 112? Okay, I see nobody. We will, we'll go online. I have a Desiree Molina and Palmer. If you can hear me, Mrs. Molina, you can begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. For record, my name is Desiree Molina. And I'm a third-year student in the UAA ISU Doctor of Pharmacy program. I was born in Anchorage and grew up and currently live in Palmer. I'm currently employed as a pharmacist intern at Three Bears Pharmacy and as the associate executive intern for the Alaska Pharmacists Association. I'm here today to provide my testimony in support of House Bill 112, which seeks to improve safety for patients and improving processes, licensing processes for pharmacists in Alaska. As a pharmacy student, I've seen just how important it is to be sure to have efficient licensure processes that prioritize public safety. House Bill 112 does just that by reducing administrative burdens, such as streamlining some of the paperwork requirements for licensing, and improving the safety of the public by requiring a national criminal background check for new licensees of those coming into the state. At this time, only Alaska criminal background checks are completed for Alaska licensure. I plan to continue practicing in Alaska upon graduation, and the passage of House Bill 112 will significantly impact my practice as a future pharmacist, as it will provide greater clarity regarding the role of pharmacists in epinephrine access. This will allow us to prescribe epinephrine auto-injectors, making this life-saving medication more readily available to patients across Alaska. Today, I ask the committee to support House Bill 112. I believe this bill will greatly benefit the healthcare industry in Alaska and enhance patient access to safe and quality healthcare. I want to thank each and every one of you for your time and consideration and for recognizing the importance of this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Molina. Moving on, we have a Dr. Justin DeMain.
Good afternoon, Chairman Sumner. Thank you. This is Dr. Jeffrey DeMain. I'm an allergist immunologist in Anchorage, Alaska. I've been practicing in Alaska for almost 30 years. I want to thank Representative Ruffridge, Means, and Fields for co-sponsoring this bill and all the other support that we have. I just wanted to give a foundation that 1 in 12 children have food allergy in Alaska, and approximately 5% of the population will have anaphylaxis sometime in their life. In the school system, 25% of children that experience anaphylaxis, which is a very severe life-threatening event, have no knowledge of the prior allergy. So it's not that they would be prepared. They have no knowledge. And that holds true with adults, but I don't have that statistic. With anaphylaxis, this is something that has to be treated promptly. Delay in management of anaphylaxis, which is epinephrine, that is the management of anaphylaxis, decreases the probability of survival. So the more delay there is, the less likely the epinephrine will be effective. So if you're pending an EMS visit, for example, it may take 10 or 15 minutes, and that may actually be too long. I wanted to reemphasize that epinephrine is the first and only true therapy for anaphylaxis other than supportive care. And access to epinephrine is currently difficult. Patients that know they have risk of anaphylaxis carry their EpiPen or whatever brand they use. And, you know, nurses and school nurses will have epinephrine available, but usually it's available in a way that it's basically for that specific student. The Asthma and Allergy Foundation of Alaska chapter, which I'm the president of, provides anaphylaxis education program. We have both in person as well as online programming, and this has been certified by the state of Alaska through Child and Maternal Health. By the way, that program is free. Once someone completes the post-test successfully, and then they go through demonstrating recognition and demonstrating the actual administration of epinephrine, they receive that certification. But right now, one of our problems is that once someone does receive that certification, they don't really have access to epinephrine. Their private provider may be comfortable prescribing it, but that may not be appropriate either, or may not be available to them. What we're recommending is that epinephrine be dispensed by the pharmacist once someone presents this certificate of completion of this course, and that way it would be accessible. And I would recommend it be almost used like Narcan in patients that have an opium overdose. So this would provide, again, increased opportunity for education. It would provide better access to epinephrine and truly could potentially save lives. And so I would really appreciate support of House Bill 112. And I'd be happy to answer any questions regarding anaphylaxis or allergies or allergic reactions.
Thank you, Dr. DeMaine. Doesn't look like there's any questions. Moving on, we have Barry Christensen from Ketchikan. Mr. Christensen, if you can hear me, please begin your testimony. Put your name on the record and begin your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My name is Barry Christensen. I'm a community pharmacist in Ketchikan. My family has owned and operated Island Pharmacy down here for 49 years, serving residents of southern southeast Alaska. I'm calling to support House Bill 112. It's been a part of work of the Board of Pharmacy for the last several boards, and it does a good job bringing our statutes up to par and includes a lot of good items. So to keep my testimony short and say I hope you can support it and pass this bill out so pharmacies like ours can help continue to serve the patients that we do. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. That looks... Brandy? Oh. Oh, we have a Brandy Sein-Martin. Ma'am, please put your name on the record and begin your testimony. And sorry, I cannot pronounce your last name.
Yes, hello. No worries at all. My name is Brandy Sign-Martin. I am a pharmacist by training and the executive director for the Alaska Pharmacists Association. I'm here to speak on behalf of the association today and just to express our support for House Bill 112. You've already heard all the great things that this bill does, so I won't get into that to save time. But we really appreciate the work of all of the Board of Pharmacy members who have put in effort over several years to get this package together and work with the association and others for stakeholder input. So thank you for hearing this bill today, and we hope that you will pass it out of committee.
Thank you. Okay, that looks to be everybody. We'll go back. Is there anybody in the room that wishes to testify on HB 112? Okay, seeing nobody, we will close public testimony. This bill has an amendment deadline for Friday morning, and we will be bringing it back to the committee during Friday's meeting. That concludes our business today. Seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 5:09 p.m.